This is Car Expert.
A part of me wants to just go, Toyota, you are mad, and what are you doing?
We're working on some systems that are actually managing and monitoring your wheel position at the wheel.
The overall sensation that I got from this car was that it's 90% there, and there's just that last little remainder that needs to be done.
Every second tradie in a ute was driving past, gawking at it. When there's a new model coming, they're very excited to hear about it.
Hello, my name is Mandy Turner. This week on the show, I'm joined by Scott Colley.
Hello, everyone.
And Will Stopford, hello.
Hey, Mandy, how's it going?
Very good, and congratulations on now working full-time for Car Expert. That's fantastic news.
Yes, it is very, very exciting, and I'm very happy.
Is this, like, your dream job?
Yeah, It basically is my dream job. This is what I've wanted to do ever since I picked up my first car magazine when I was 4 years old. So at some points in my life, I didn't think I'd actually get into this industry, and now here I am. So it's very exciting. It kind of hasn't sunk in yet.
That's awesome. Scully, I know the Melbourne team really can't review cars at the moment because of our stage four lockdown. So you've been doing some reminiscing.
I had a flashback this week to one of my favorite motor show moments, which came before Car Advice and before Car Expert. A friend of mine sent me a photo from a trip we took to the States. And on that trip, I ducked off to Detroit to do the motor show in January, which is no longer in January. It was meant to be in July this year, but that was cancelled because Detroit initially early in the COVID-19 outbreak was in all sorts of trouble, and the hall they used was converted to a field hospital. But before Car Advice and Car Expert, I worked for a website called New Atlas, which is still around and still covers some really interesting tech stuff. And rather than going to a motor show with one manufacturer and staying in a very nice hotel and all that sort of thing, New Atlas would pay for what was quite a cheap hotel in Detroit. And the goal would just be to cover as many of the press conferences as possible and get as many photos as possible. So having flown into Detroit late the night before, it was about negative 15 because January is the pits of winter in the US, obviously. Staying in a hotel where number two on the TripAdvisor list was bulletproof glass when it comes to the features it has. And it's about 7:30 in the morning on day one and at the Mercedes-Benz press conference. It was when they were launching the SLC, which is the sort of updated version of the SLK Roadster. And in an attempt to make the presentation for the journos more interesting, Mercedes got this pop star, whose name I cannot remember because I haven't heard her song since, to perform at the start of their press conference. And it, she came out on stage, and I'd been at the Chevrolet press conference previously. I was trying to write that story and upload photos while the Merc press conference was going on. And she's charging around on stage and singing and dancing and, like, doing the whole thing, really trying hard. And she finally finished her performance, and the boss of Mercedes came on stage. At the time, it was Dr. Z, who was a very serious man with a walrus sort of mustache. And he goes, "What a wonderful performance. That is the sort of song I would like to listen to when I take this car on a road trip through America. How can we thank you?" And the pop star, clearly, I still can't remember her name, thought that she'd done a good enough job that she could be a bit funny. And so she goes, "Well, I mean, you could thank me by giving me a car." And Dr. Z goes, "Ha ha, what a wonderful joke. Please take off the stage." And she was just escorted off stage. And he jumped straight into the presentation. He goes, "The new SLC has the new folding type roof and the new engines from Mercedes." Straight into it. Not even like a pause as this woman's being escorted backstage. That was the end of it.
That's incredible.
You've got to love dry German humor.
It was the most remarkable thing I've seen in one of those, because there was, it was just everything about it was so strange, and she was just bundled out. I assume in her costume, she was pushed into the negative 15 Detroit day to find her own way home.
This is probably why you've never heard from her ever since.
Oh, no. Yeah, that's it. She froze outside the Kobo Center.
What an amazing story. Have you guys ever built plastic model kits of cars or planes or tanks or whatever?
Look, I'm too lazy. I buy my diecast models already assembled, so I've never actually done that.
I do buy lots of diecast models. It's usually the first thing I go to at the supermarket is the toy aisle. But I've been making model kits in isolation because there's not much else you can really do. And I've just completed the biggest model kit I've ever made, which was a Revel double-decker Routemaster bus from the 1960s, and it has 395 pieces, and it is probably as long as your arm. It's a massive model kit. It took me since COVID began, so March, just completed it now, so I'm almighty proud of it.
I was going to ask you, of all the options you had, your Sistine Chapel of building models, you chose a bus?
I've always had this weird fascination for them since I was a kid, and I have no idea why. I've never been on one. I've never been to London. I just sort of like the look of them. I'm a car person. I love beautiful lines and angles of a car, but for some reason this double-decker Routemaster bus has always appealed to me. And when I saw it at a hobby shop one day, I literally bought it on the spot. It was super expensive. But it has been worth it because this is how I've spent COVID building a double-decker bus.
And where are you going to display it, Mandy?
I have no idea. Oh. There's already the side mirrors are already broken off, and I've got to move house, so it'll be probably broken again at some point. I don't know. It'll probably sit in the box in a cupboard at some point, but at the moment I like admiring it.
did you have like a finish date in mind for it, and did it arrive sort of 10 to 15 minutes after it was meant to be finished is my main question.
Well, I've had it for about 12 months.
Okay.
And I did the engine, then put it away. I'm like, stuff this. This is too complicating. But yeah, when COVID hit, I was bored. I read all the books I wanted to read, and I wasn't working. So I thought I'd bring it out. And I thought it would have taken me till the end of the year. So I've now have an obsession with building model kits. And I've bought, what have I bought? A Mazda MX-5, the latest gen one, and a Honda S600.
Oh, very cool. Little K
those
car.
Tiny little sports cars from the 60s. Yeah. So they're my next projects. Anyway, let's get into the show, shall we?
Longest intro ever.
Here is this week's car news, and Scully, General Motors has spoken out after the criticism focused at its new brand GM SV.
It has. So Holden obviously was shut down earlier this year, and when that was announced, GM essentially said, we're still going to bring some cars to Australia, but it's only going to be the really exciting stuff, like the Corvette, the Silverado, really playing in a niche sort of area. And obviously some people were pretty unhappy about that, having killed a whole lot of agreements with its dealers and having, you know, taken a brand that Australians have grown up with and loved away, and then coming back later on is a strategy that's going to leave some people upset. But this week, the Australian Automotive Dealer Association, which essentially is the peak body that represents dealers in Australia, funnily enough, has just sort of come out and said, we really need to look into how the business is being set up, because under Australian law, General Motors and Holden needs to support the existing fleet of cars on the roads, which is 1.6 million vehicles. There's a huge fleet of Holdens on Australian roads. And it needs to supply parts for them and be able to fund repairs for them for the next 10 years. And so the question that's being asked is, in the shift from Holden to GMSV, has General Motors moved money around that means maybe it won't be able to pay for big recalls and big fixes down the track? General Motors obviously says that's not the case. It's come out and said it's 100% committed to supporting Holden customers and their 1.6 million Holden vehicles with after-sales services. It's also said that it's not doing something called phoenixing, which I actually had to Google, but there was an Australian senator that came out and called for an investigation into this practice, which is essentially when a business is shut down and all its assets are moved somewhere else, and then it starts up doing the same thing again, but without the debts and liabilities of the old business. General Motors has been really firm in its defense against this as well. Essentially saying it's simply absurd to accuse it of shutting down Holden to then do the same thing with GMSV, because GMSV is obviously a very different business operating in a very different niche to mainstream Holden.
Mm. Has there been any word on what's going to happen to HSV at all?
So HSV is essentially becoming GMSV. At the moment, HSV is converting Silverados from left-hand drive to right-hand drive. It's finished its Camaro program now. And so that operation will just roll on into GMSV. And a lot of HSV dealers are expected to become GMSV dealers. So if you have been involved in HSV or been watching what that company is doing, there's been some really interesting stuff with the Ute conversion, and that's going to keep on going under the GMSV banner, which is a good news story for Aussie manufacturing.
Mm. Do you reckon this is too soon, considering the closure of Holden was, what, 6 odd months ago? I actually thought it would have taken a bit longer for all this to happen.
Yeah, look, I understand why people have reacted the way they have to GMSV. General Motors as a company has been seen as quite ruthless around the world, not just in Australia, for a little while now, in the way that it will set up companies and set up businesses and shut them down very quickly. It's quite ruthless in a business sense that, despite, you know, all the nostalgia and the weight that brands carry, the big American head office is not afraid to swing the axe when it suits it. So yeah, it doesn't surprise me people have reacted this way. I think if you are General Motors, the longer you leave it, the harder it's going to be to get something like GMSV off the ground. Already it has the dealer infrastructure with HSV. Already it has everything set up to convert the Silverado to right-hand drive. And already it has confirmation that the Corvette's coming in right-hand drive. So from the perspective of how it looks, I completely see that, you know, maybe it looks like GM has culled Holden and then gone, oh, by the way, we're back. And I don't love the optics of that, because even though I, you know, didn't grow up in a really Holden family, as an Australian, I feel an attachment to the brand. But by the same token, I think that we need to be realistic about the fact that we're still going to be getting some good products. And if you can see past the GM side of it and look at what we're getting, it's a good news story that we're getting the big Silverado that, from all reports, is converted to a really high standard. And, of course, the Corvette is so exciting. So, I mean, there's bad parts to it, but on the whole, I think Australians are still getting, you know, at least part of a good deal out of GMSV.
Yeah. We'd be keen to hear your thoughts on this topic. You can send us an email through podcast@carexpert.com.au. Now, moving on to the SUV world, Will, we have the pricing and specs for the first SUV by Genesis, the GV80. How much are we up for this giant SUV?
Yes, well, the GV80 is opening at $90,600 before on-road costs. So there are three engines that are going to be offered in all Genesis markets, and we're actually getting all three. So that base engine, unlike a base BMW X5 or Mercedes-Benz GLE, the base engine is actually a petrol. So it's a 2.5-litre turbo petrol. Then the next step up in the range is a 3-litre turbo diesel inline six, which is an all-new engine. And there's also the new 3.5-litre turbocharged V6 petrol, capping the range there. It's really interesting because I guess there's been a bit of a reaction on social about this. It isn't priced that far away from German rivals. I know a lot of people think, well, Genesis is, you know, part of Hyundai. So where's the really sharp, crazy keen pricing of like the 13990XLs of back in the day? It's not quite that sharp in how it's been priced, but it still does undercut key rivals. And the features list is exhausting to type. So even in the very base model, you're looking at ambient lighting, heated and ventilated front seats, 12-way power front seats. Some of those things are options. If you look at a Range Rover Sport, for example, it opens at a very similar price point, but all of that stuff is bundled into options packages. It's a very, very, very high level of specification. But the pricing is, you know, some might argue it's a little bit ambitious for an upstart brand.
This caused some really good arguments, not only in the comments, but within our own internal messaging, which is an argument we'd usually have face-to-face, but obviously that's not an option at the moment, between people saying that Genesis needs to price its cars significantly cheaper than the Germans to cut through in the market. And the other side of that is that if you price your car cheap, people will think it's a cheap car. And the GV80 isn't a cheap car. By all reports, it's very nice to drive out of those launch drives that came last year. And it does come with a lot of really cool stuff. Where do we sit on sort of what Genesis is doing? Because I can see both sides of that argument.
Yeah, so can I. And I think a lot of people are very quick to cite Lexus as an example of a brand created out of nothing that's challenged the established German rivals. And when Lexus came out, you know, it had the LS400, which was S-class levels of refinement and power and features at mid-spec E-class and 5 series pricing. So it was very, very, very sharply priced. It was a very impressive car. I think the way Genesis has, it's Genesis's Genesis, has been very interesting because they only came here, what, 12 months ago. The brand is only new globally as well. And already they're getting into really profitable, really important segments for the luxury market. A lot of people criticize them because they launched with 2 sedans and people are buying far fewer sedans than before. But they've actually been quicker to get into key markets than even Lexus was. If you think what was the hot ticket in the 90s, it was, among other things, 3 series rivals. And Lexus didn't actually get into the segment, into that particular segment with the IS until 97, 98. So Genesis has been very, very quick there to get into segments. And they're from you know, what we've seen, they're all very, very impressive looking vehicles.
How do we think Genesis is going to go without people being able to, I suppose, just walk into a dealership and say, hey, I'd like to go and take this for a drive, considering it is a brand new model?
Well, Mandy, I mean, even if they could go into a dealership, Genesis still only has one studio, as they call them, nationwide. There's another one opening, I believe they said, later this year in Melbourne. So it's just the one in Sydney for the moment. And then there's one that should be opening in Brisbane next year. So even if they could generate that kind of idle kind of showroom strolling in, they actually can't because they don't currently have the dealership infrastructure to support that.
What Genesis has done recently is open a new, and I can't remember the name they gave it, which is a little bit annoying, but a new, it's not quite a dealership because they want to do the boutique model, but a place you can actually go and drive the cars. Whereas previously to test drive the cars, you had to tee up or go and look at the boutique, tee up someone delivering the car to you, test drive it and have it taken back, which I think is a really good idea in theory, but in practice, people maybe want to spend some time kicking tires and wandering around a showroom. So Genesis has moved towards that model a little bit, and maybe in a way that I don't know it thought it would initially. But yeah, it is tricky when, like in Melbourne, for example, near where I live, there's a massive row of dealerships, everything from Havel and MG all the way through to Lexus, BMW and Mercedes. And if you are the sort of person who is on the fence about, you know, what sort of car you're going to buy and you're hopping from dealer to dealer, it not having a presence in places like that could be the difference between a sale or not a sale. So I think no matter how good the product, early on with such a small footprint, it's going to be a pretty slow burn.
Okay, now moving on to perhaps the biggest news story of the week. We finally have pricing for the 2020 Toyota Yaris. And while it's an all-new car, the price still has come at a bit of a shock to us all. The outgoing Yaris was priced at $16,000 drive away, whereas the 2020 model starts at $22,130 before on-road costs.
Sorry, just suddenly picked my jaw up off the table. What?
I know. I'm speaking so much truth here. You might need to do it again, Scully, because the top of the range ZR hybrid starts at $32,100 before on roads, which means it's mixing it in with the prices of the Corolla now, which is a much bigger car. So before we get into the prices and what do you get for that money, a 1.5-litre three-cylinder petrol engine, 88 kilowatts of power at 145 newton metres of torque. It comes with a choice of a six-speed manual or a CVT. The hybrid is a 1.5-litre engine with 67 kilowatts and 120 newton metres for the petrol engine and 59 kilowatts and 141 newton metres for the electric motor. That puts the combined power output to 85 kilowatts. There is a heap of equipment to go through across the three specs, which you can take a read on the site. But starting off with the base model, all these come standard: autonomous emergency braking, lane keeping assist, rear cross traffic alert, and active cruise control. The first 5 services are capped at $170 each. So, Scully, I'm really keen to hear your thoughts on this.
Look, a part of me wants to just go, Toyota, you are mad, and what are you doing? Because we have this expectation of entry-level cars being cheap and cheerful, and 22,130 or whatever the starting price is for a car with steel wheels and a manual, which no one will buy, regardless of how cheap you want your car to be. People buy autos now. Is a huge departure from what we expect. I think we need to put it in a little bit of context, and part of that is cheap and cheerful cars used to be cheap because they had nothing in them. They weren't particularly safe. They had no, you know, mod cons inside. And, you know, the Yaris had been around for quite a long time. So that's how Toyota eventually gets to the point of being able to offer it at $15,990 drive away. Even with that considered, it just seems too expensive to me. Even when you think of all of the things it's got that the old one didn't, all the stuff it has that the Corolla has, if I'm walking into a showroom and I'm looking at a car that small with that little boot space, you know, even though the Corolla doesn't have a massive boot, it's still got more boot space, more space in the rear, and more tech in the front than the Yaris. I just don't quite understand how Toyota expects buyers to get over that hill, because no matter how many times you say it doesn't, size matters, or so I'm reliably informed.
It's very true too.
I even saw some of the commenters on the site saying, well, you could seriously look at the Volkswagen Polo or the Golf for that money. Just crazy.
It's definitely getting towards Golf, or I mean, it is Polo money, especially at the top end. You can get a Polo GTI for the top spec ZR money, and I know the Yaris is going to be much more efficient, but without even thinking, I can tell you where my money's going on that front. it's a really interesting one. The other thing is Toyota is the best-selling car company in Australia by the absolute length of the straight, and it rarely misses. So we're sitting here criticizing, and it's going to be very interesting to see how this plays out. But maybe Toyota knows something we don't is the only logical explanation I can think of, because as a company that's rooted in rational, sensible cars and rational, sensible product planning, a lot goes into making these decisions. This doesn't happen on a whim. I'd love to know what they know that we don't, because in my head, it's too expensive.
And it's interesting too, because the Corolla and the Camry are relatively sharply priced for their segments. So this, I think what's probably going to happen is we're going to see MG3 sales continue to rise. The segment's really being hollowed out. So many competitors have left. Hyundai's sales volume dropped down quite a bit because they discontinued the Accent, which was another kind of value-priced model. So it's very interesting to see the base price of the Yaris climb by so much. I know Toyota has got that almost bloody peerless reputation, but that's a much higher base price, and I think that's a big hill to climb. It's not like we live in a city like Prague or London, for example, where having a smaller car is really desirable. If there is such a small price difference between a Yaris and a comparably spec'd Corolla, I think we tend to be in this country very much appreciative of value for money. And I think most people would just go, well, it's just a little bit extra. I may as well get a Corolla.
All right. And lastly, Scully, Skoda is trialling a 7-year warranty, but just in Victoria. Why did they decide on Victoria?
Victoria's had a rough trot of things lately. So I think it's just Skoda, for one, trying to sell cars at a time where people can't go to dealerships. Rather than shutting down completely, everything's gone online and you can still spec and order cars. And in an attempt to sweeten the deal or to get people to sign on the dotted line when maybe they'd wait or not do it, Skoda is trialing a 7-year factory warranty. It's also throwing in a 3-year service pack in Victoria for anyone who buys a Skoda. And the Scala's been delayed, so that 3-year service pack is actually being offered around the country for Scala buyers while they wait for a little start-stop problem to be fixed. It's interesting in that, I suppose, 2020's forced car makers to do things that they probably previously thought they'd never have to do. And because Victoria is in such a strict lockdown, Skoda's taken the decision that rather than not do anything and not push for sales at all and just cop the loss for 6 weeks or however long this interminable lockdown goes for, it's going to try and sweeten the deal a little bit and just keep sales ticking over. So obviously people won't take delivery during the lockdown, but if they do sign on the dotted line during this 6-week period, they'll get a 7-year warranty, which also points to the fact that down the track, Skoda may move to a permanent 7-year warranty. The boss we spoke to this week, and that story will actually be live when you're listening to this podcast, said that they're not committing to a 7-year warranty in the future, but by the same token, they're keeping a very close eye on customer feedback, which is what they did when they moved from a 3-year to a 5-year warranty. And it's a pretty common move in the industry to start things as a trial, and then when people, you know, get happy with the extra value, which obviously you would be if you're getting 7 instead of 5 years of coverage, then make it permanent. So yeah, watch this space, I think.
Skoda is part of a few other manufacturers who have trialed just a 7-year warranty. I think Holden did it in Mitsubishi. So it will be interesting whether they do stick with this or it might come back permanent a little bit later on down the track.
It will be interesting to see because, Holden obviously isn't offering anything at the moment, but Honda and Mitsubishi sort of switch it on and switch it off depending on what they're offering and what cars they're pushing. It'll be very interesting to see.
Yeah. I remember years ago, 7-year warranties were obviously just unheard of. If somebody told you, there'll be 7-year new car warranties soon, you would have looked at them like they were crazy. So it's really, really interesting to see how many manufacturers in this country have signed on to offer 7-year warranties. I'm pretty sure Kia was the first from memory, but so many have followed. And it just makes me think, is 7 years it? Are manufacturers going to go higher in the future? I don't know.
In the USA, Kia offers 10, I think. So I'd imagine there's a point where it just gets too expensive. But if you're trying to build confidence, it seems like a really good way to show people you're serious about your product being reliable.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
If you would like to read further in detail about these stories, you can head to carexpert.com.au. Time for a Car Expert review, and we welcome back the bright and cheery Mike Costello.
Hello, Mandy. I feel like that was a slight dig.
That's an ambush if I've ever heard one. Sorry.
I feel like I should have responded by being even more morose than usual.
No, you're always bright and cheery. I was not being sarcastic. The MGHS you have reviewed. Can you tell us a bit about this one for us?
The MGHS, yeah, of course. So MG, it's a Chinese brand these days, owned by the Shanghai Automotive Industrial Corporation, or SAIC Motor, one of the world's biggest car companies, absolutely enormous, making a really big play in markets across Europe and Australia. And the HS is its flagship model. So it's kind of a Mazda 6 5-sized, mid-sized SUV, so it competes in that real sweet spot. Funnily enough, it's not going for the super cheap and cheerful end. Rather, its pricing is more in line with base versions of better-known rivals like the CX-5 and Hyundai Tucson, but it comes with a heck of a lot more equipment. And on the face of it, there's a reason why this brand is really selling so well. It's in the top 15 in Australia now, this brand, MG. More than 6,000 cars sold over the first half of the year. And it's got a 7-year factory warranty, looks pretty handsome. It's got all the requisite infotainment tech and active safety tech. So when you're looking at this car in the showroom, there's a part of you that thinks, maybe I'm willing to take a chance on a brand I don't know so well.
What sort of pricing are we looking at with this car?
So it kicks off at $30,990 drive away for the entry-level Vibe, but I had the version called Excite, which is $34,790. And so that really puts it alongside someone like a Tucson Active X or a Kia Sportage SX, a Honda CR-V in sort of low grade. So real entry-level models, but it doesn't get entry-level equipment. So it's got auto headlights, LED daytime running lights and tail lights, a proximity key fob, a 10.1-inch touchscreen, fake leather seats, Apple CarPlay and Android Auto, LED headlights, auto wipers, climate control, sat nav, really, really well equipped. And then on top of that, you get a whole suite of active safety tech. So a 5-star ANCAP rating, ISOFIX and 6 airbags, but also blind spot monitoring, active cruise control, autonomous emergency braking that recognise cycles and pedestrians, lane keeping aid with steering assist, door opening warning. So really it's bringing features to that price point that very few other cars can actually bring to the table.
I think there's sometimes an expectation with Chinese cars that it looks great on paper, but it isn't necessarily all that well put together in person. Does the HS as an all-new model actually feel, you know, really solidly put together and a match for Kia and Mazda and Hyundai?
It actually does. And in some ways, inside, it feels quite premium. Everything is nice. And I know it's a bit of a stereotype for, you know, journalists to get kind of pilloried for talking about soft touch materials, but everything in there is soft. The actual fit and finish is really good. You know, the typical tests you do, like grabbing the transmission tunnel and trying to move it from side to side, well, it doesn't move. There's very little squeaking going on, very little rattling going on. It all looks quite modern and sophisticated. There's still some UX issues, so there's still too many features controlled through the touchscreen rather than through hard buttons. So there's a little bit of a UX issue there. But in terms of the way it presents, and I think the old pub test for me is if you were to put some tape over the giant octagonal MG badge on the steering wheel and asked somebody where this car comes from, would they say this is some cheap, nasty Chinese product? And the answer is no. In actual fact, in terms of build quality and look and design, it's every bit as good as its Korean or Japanese rivals.
So, Moco, what's under the bonnet and how does it drive?
Well, there is a 1.5-litre turbo petrol engine, which sounds pretty diminutive, but let's not forget that a Honda CR-V has a 1.5 turbo and a Volkswagen Tiguan has a 1.4-litre turbo, so displacement isn't what it was. 119 kilowatts of power and 250 newton metres of peak torque driven through the front wheels via a 7-speed dual-clutch transmission. So, you know, it's got some pretty sophisticated on paper there. 7.3 litres per 100 k's is the claimed fuel use, although it does require premium petrol. And I did the 0 to 100 kilometre an hour dash in 10.2 seconds. Now, it's worth pointing out that early next year, a 170 kilowatt turbo 2 litre and a plug-in hybrid version are both expected. But for now, it's kind of got that fairly sort of middling engine. Now, like a lot of small turbos, it has its peak torque on tap from quite low in the rev band. So you don't need to rev the crap out of it to get the most from it. On the other side, because it's a dual clutch and because it's a small capacity turbo, it's also not as immediately responsive as, say, a naturally aspirated Hyundai Tucson might be. And I would say that the fuel economy, while 7.3 is a decent claim, I averaged 8.4, which, considering it also has premium fuel, is not particularly good. It's not exactly thirsty, but it's not particularly good. In terms of the way it drives, I think this is a car that's really crying out for maybe the last 5% to be fettled. So that the actual refinement of that DCT is quite good. I mean, a Nissan Juke's double clutch gearbox is far jerkier and less responsive than the MG's, so it's actually not too bad. The steering is quite nicely weighted, I should say. Its ride quality is decent enough. It doesn't have ridiculously oversized wheels or skinny sidewall tires, so it actually absorbs most bumps and hits pretty well, except for the really, really sharp stuff. And even on like corrugated gravel roads, it doesn't handle too badly. I wouldn't mind having all-wheel drive as an option. That's one thing that I would quite like. And there's also a giant red button on the steering wheel that's called Super Sport, which makes you think that this thing might be some high performance Uber SUV, but in actual fact all it does is tell a gearbox to hold lower ratios for a bit longer and doesn't really do much. But if you have a look on paper at its power to weight ratio, it's right on par with any of the class. It's got the requisite McPherson struts at the front and multi-link independent suspension at the rear, Michelin Primacy tires at each end, so it is sporting. You know, it's not got crappy Chinese no-name rubber that nobody's ever heard of. And the other good thing I like about it is the actual NVH. So the noise suppression is pretty good. It's just those final 5% of things that could be improved. You'll notice, I remember that when Hyundai and Kia decided to do Australian suspension tuning, it really revolutionized that brand. And I'm not necessarily suggesting that MG does that, but it does need to have a look at the very best in the class and just make a very few small changes. What was more problematic was the active safety tech. I know Albor spent a lot of time really digging in on the active safety tech on this car. And on paper, it's all great. And lots of it works pretty well. So the active cruise control does the job. It matches the speed ahead. The lane assist system, it will nudge you back between the lines and steer you through corners on highways really well. The blind spot monitoring light lights up when there's a car in your blind spot. So it all works as advertised. The problem is it's very intrusive. So every time it does anything at all, it has to beep at you or make a flash at you or tell you that it's doing something. You know, the whole point of these systems is that they help the driver, but this system is constantly telling you that it's helping you to the point where it starts to drive you insane and you just switch it off. So it works, but again, that UX just needs to be slightly improved. So the overall sensation that I got from this car across all of the parameters that we test and we drive it was that it's 90% there and there's just that last little remainder that needs to be done.
Yeah, so I went to the press launch for that. That was actually my first press launch for the HS, and you're absolutely right. Inside and out looks nice. It's actually a really nice interior for that price point. But one of the things that I mentioned in my launch review is that active safety technology. I think it was the lane keeping assist worked above, from memory, I think it was the lane keeping assist. If you went above a certain speed, that's when it started working. But as soon as you drop below that speed, there'd be a little warning notification in the gauge cluster saying, system deactivated. It's like, well, you don't really need to tell me that. There were lots of pings, there were lots of beeps and things like that. So the amount of active safety tech at that price point is really impressive. But as you said, and as Alb was said in his review, it just needs a little bit more finessing.
Yeah, it's trying to democratize that tech. And the whole point of a cheap, well, I shouldn't say cheap, but a relatively sharply priced Chinese car with all this equipment is to democratize these features. And if these features work, but they're intrusive, then they're going to alienate prospective buyers, which is kind of defeating the purpose. Now, one thing we do know is that Chinese companies move fast, and MG has had a lot of feedback from press in Europe and press in Australia saying pretty much what I've said here, and has already pledged that it's going to roll out some sort of patch updates as it goes. And given the form that this company has had previously, I would expect those changes to be made pretty quickly. It's not like it's going to wait for a new generation car. It'll do it pretty quickly. Something else I should probably touch on is it's been quite clever, a bit like Hyundai was in the early days or a bit like Kia did. It's really nailed the warranty proposition, MG. So it's a factory distributor for one thing, which is really important. It's not an independent distributor. The actual company itself brings the cars here and it has a 7-year warranty, which gives you a lot of reassurance because there's going to be people who say, well, all right, I could have a luxurious, well-equipped Chinese car, but I could sacrifice a couple of features but get a brand that I know and trust. But if there's a 7-year warranty there waiting for you, maybe that will sort of change your mind as well. And I think, you know, that is a real selling point for the brand and it sort of gives people permission to take a bit of a punt.
So if it was your money, Moco, you've said it's, what, 10% off, but it is also 5, 10, maybe more percent cheaper than the equivalent Hyundai or Kia. Would you recommend someone goes into an MG showroom and drives one, or would you still be pointing them towards the established sort of group if you are looking for an SUV in that area?
Personally, I'm a little bit conservative with these things. I think I wouldn't be somebody who says that the car would be unreliable. There's no reason to say that this MG will be any less reliable than anything else. I've been to MG's factory in Shanghai. I've been to its R&D center in Shanghai before. And, you know, it's world-class when it comes to its R&D. So I don't think there's any issues with reliability to be feared. But I would say that as a car buyer, when it's your own money, there is a natural tendency towards maybe swaying in the direction of something that's a known quantity, that's got some runs on the board, that has been around before. So if it was my mum or a good friend of mine, I would probably still be inclined to steer them into a demonstrator mid-level Tucson or Sportage or CX-5 or an entry-level one and get them to sacrifice some equipment to get that badge would be my personal take, if I'm honest with you. But I do think that what MG's done pretty well here is it's given you enough doubt to at least look at it. You know, the whole challenge for a challenger brand, a contender brand like this is just to get its foot in the door at all. And there are those people that will disagree with me and there are those people that will look at what this offers and they will say, you know what, I don't really care that it doesn't have the runs on the board. I'm going to put my money behind it anyway. And I can understand that viewpoint. Personally, though, I'd probably still go with the tried and true. Let MG just spend a few more years really proving its wares. And then once the products start to arrive in next generation form, maybe then pull the trigger.
And we've seen how quickly as well MG has just really upped its game with every successive generation of car it's brought out. When it first relaunched after being bought by the Chinese with the MG6, that wasn't really anything to write home about. each car, I mean, even if you just look at interior design and quality alone, at one point you had the 6 and the ZS on dealer lots, or leftover 6s and the ZS on dealer lots, and the HS was coming in. And one day I went to my local MG dealer, and I just went and sat in all of the lineup, and you could just see with each generation how much they've upped the game. And that's just in interior design. That's not even taking into account how they actually drive on the road. So I think if we couldn't recommend an HS now, and potentially by the next generation of MG vehicle, it might be something that, you know, you might not have any reservations about recommending, but we'll just have to see.
Yeah, put it this way. If again, and I'll use that example, if my mum or girlfriend or great friend, you know, drove over to my house and said, "Hey, I've bought an MGHS," I wouldn't be horrified. I wouldn't shake my head. I wouldn't, you know, yell at them and say, "What the hell are you doing? You must have lost your mind." I understand. You know, this is a car that definitely has some appeal, and it's got a lot of positives about it. And to be quite frank, there's too many times where I've driven cars from startup brands where I haven't even been able to say that. So, you know, I gave it a 7.4 out of 10 for my overall rating, which is nothing to sort of turn your nose up at. And it's definitely a car that has perhaps more merit than a lot of people would expect.
You can read up more on the MGHS at carexpert.com.au. And we thank you, Mike Costello.
You are most welcome, Mandy.
A few weeks ago, Mike Costello spoke about Doftec, the brains behind an Australian invention, the Active Wheel Alignment System. Well, now we have the chance to talk to the man who invented it, car enthusiast, co-founder and engineer, Dr. Jeff Rogers. Welcome to Car Expert.
Thank you very much.
Congratulations on producing a world-first piece of technology. For anyone who hasn't caught up on what this new system is, can you explain how it works?
Yeah, sure. So basically, one of the most important factors in any car is determining how the car behaves, how it handles, fuel efficiency, things like that, is actually the way the tires contact the road, and optimizing the way they interact with the road, optimizing that little contact patch, you know, between the tire and the road. And up to this point, nobody's ever really come up with a system that allows the contact patch to be optimized at all times. And so 3 years ago, we set about coming up with a solution to what we saw as a problem that we wanted a solution to that didn't exist. And so what we've done is developed what we call the world's first active wheel alignment system. It attaches on the car, controls all of your wheel alignment parameters on the car, and basically seeks to optimize those parameters at in real time at all times while you're driving around the road.
Jeff, your background is quite impressive. Can you tell us a little more about you and how you got to where you are today at Doftec?
Yeah, sure. So I've taken the less direct path through life, I guess, as an engineer. I have changed industries a little bit. I guess I started out actually going to university to study mechanical engineering. I did mechanical because there wasn't an automotive engineering course. If there was, I would have been straight into that. Cars have always been my passion, and from my family, you know, cars run, you know, oil runs through our veins type thing. So, but I studied mechanical engineering, as I said, and then at the time when I was graduating, I guess the GFC was happening, and so things were pretty tough, and I ended up taking a PhD project that was still engineering, but it was in the medical field, designing and developing new surgical devices for saving lives. And so that's really where I started, I guess, is my design career as an engineer. I managed to actually invent and develop some products in that space, and started my first company right out of university that developed a new technology for treating heart disease. That company was actually acquired, and that technology is heading off to market now under the hands of the world leader in that space. And since then, I kind of been moving across from healthcare to automotive, I guess, with Doftec and the active wheel alignment system. So as I say, perhaps the path less traveled, but that's been my trajectory.
So Jeff, for stupid people like me, how does the system actually work, because you say it can be plugged into existing suspension systems or it can be integrated on a manufacturer level. How do you take all the really complex suspension geometry that already exists in cars out there and then tweak it on the fly if it hasn't been developed with the car to start with?
Yeah, look, it's a great question. And I think it comes to a point of differentiation for us as a company. Companies like Mercedes, Ford, Ferrari, Hyundai even publicly have been playing around with concepts that try to, I guess, achieve what we've done since even 2005. But the approach they took was quite different to ours. Theirs was really a ground-up design, possibly with a fundamentally different suspension system than what we have in cars today. Whereas ours was literally a frustration, a personal frustration. It was my car was where it really started, and I wanted this system on my car. So our first ever invention or design was actually to fit and suit an existing car, hence the fact that, you know, it can be bolted on and integrated either at that level or at the, you know, car maker level. But I guess how we do it, you know, obviously there's quite a bit of detail in it, but we take fairly simple technology and we apply some really novel concepts about how we integrate with the existing suspension systems that are there to preserve everything that works really well in suspension today, but add our one bit of functionality. So kind of perhaps a significant improvement, but, you know, just adding that piece of improvement into suspension. So in a nutshell, that's kind of what we do.
Jeff, what were some of the challenges you faced over 2 or 3 years, you said, of designing and engineering this system?
Yeah. I mean, there's more than one. The first is always, you know, how do you, especially with suspension, like one of our greatest challenges and perhaps some of our greatest intellectual property is around how you design a system that can support and manage the very high loads that pass through the suspension system, but also achieve adjustment, be able to like essentially articulate or move that suspension system without using a very big, heavy electric motor, for example. So we spent a lot of time working out how to manage those loads and how to achieve that. And probably the other thing, I think, probably the biggest challenge we have today, other than COVID, which is probably exacerbating it, is being in Australia, being on the other side of the world, I guess, from where a lot of our potential commercial partners are, you know, car makers and the like, and trying to, commercialize this technology into, you know, the car maker sphere from here.
So why would you want to actually change your wheel alignment on the fly? I understand that if it's out of alignment, being able to actively bring it back in makes a lot of sense. But what would you be able to change in the way a car handles by changing its setup on the move?
Yeah, sure, a lot. So we really talk about these two different scenarios. Scenario one is your everyday driving your car to from the shops or whatever, or a better example might be highway driving. So when you're driving down the highway, you want a very neutral wheel alignment, basically the wheels straight up and down, that type of thing, so that you're getting full contact of your rubber with the road. That's going to reduce your fuel consumption, it's going to reduce your emissions, and it's also going to reduce your tire wear or increase your tire life. But when you then start cornering, or you need to swerve to avoid an obstacle, or if you're using your car in a, you know, weekend sporty kind of way, you actually need a different set of settings to optimize, to give you full contact patch between your tire and the road for that scenario. And that's where you need, say, a lot of negative camber on the front of the car, for example. And so in terms of the gains that we see, compared to a car driving around the road today, if you implement our system on an everyday passenger vehicle and you go highway driving, we can reduce your rolling resistance by about 10% over your cars today. And if you fit our system to the same cars, you can also, at the flick of a button or a moment later with, you know, an adaptive change of the settings, you can actually improve the handling performance by even more than 15%. So you can get that kind of optimized situation at all times, if that makes sense.
And how far are we from a world where this could actually be integrated in a sports car from the factory? Because it sort of sounds like science fiction, next-gen tech, but presumably it's not that far away.
Yeah, look, we hope it's not that far away. From our perspective, it's not. I think where we're at as a company, we We've had a lot of interest from car makers and partners around the world from all different walks of life, whether that's supercar companies through to mobility companies as well for like autonomous vehicles and electric vehicles. I'm hoping, you know, with pre-production and pre-development and things like that, we're probably at a horizon of something like 3 to 5 years for the first one to come out on market in a new car. But we're also looking at some other opportunities in the meantime that could see the technology on market with some other applications before then.
Sounds really exciting. Jeff, lastly, what's next for Dovtech? Have you got any other projects that you're working on at the moment?
Yeah, well, I think for us, our mandate is really to become the world leaders in wheel alignment broadly, but more specifically in active wheel alignment. For us, we're spending a lot of our research and development budget right now working on adaptive systems, advanced adaptive systems, so things that are predictive, things that are changing automatically for you all the time when you're driving around and predicting what's about to happen to give you the best safety and handling. And also, we're working on some systems that are actually managing and monitoring your wheel position at the wheel so that you are getting correct wheel alignment regardless of what's happening at all times, even if you hit a pothole and your suspension geometry goes out type of thing. So that's really where we're focused, as I say, around becoming and cementing our position as the world leader in this particular space.
Certainly won't be the last time we hear from you, Jeff. We'll have to get you back on the podcast in the very near future. Jeff Rogers from Dovtech, thank you so much.
No, thanks for your time, guys. Appreciate it.
And that puts an end to this week's podcast. Will, you've been behind the wheel of the new Isuzu D-Max. I know it's been under embargo, but have you been enjoying the drive?
Look, yesterday I just had to take our photographer to snap a few photos of one. Next week I'll actually have one for the whole week. So I'm excited to actually get some proper time behind the wheel, not just driving from point to point. I will say, though, in the very brief amount of time I was driving it yesterday, this is not a driving impression. it is an observation. Everyone kept looking at it, like driving a bright orange one. But we went to take some photos in like a fairly kind of industrial area. So every second tradie in a ute was driving past gawking at it. I had one guy, he thought he was being really clever. He like pulled over and he was like snapping photos through his window. And I'm like, oh, that guy's taking a photo. And then another guy pulled up not 2 minutes later. And he's like, oh, man. Is that the new D-Max? Can I take some photos of it? I'm like, well, at least you asked. It certainly does get attention. I think a lot of people know what the D-Max is. So when there's a new model coming, they're very excited to hear about it. So can't tell you how it drives yet, but I'm looking forward to getting some real time behind the wheel.
Wouldn't it be funny to put that side by side to, I don't know, a Ferrari or a Lamborghini and see which one gets the most looks?
That's actually funny that you say that, because Albor took me for a drive today in his Ferrari, and he was saying the reactions he gets when driving his Ferrari are very, very different to the reactions he gets when he drives his Lamborghini. So,
what a fact.
Yeah.
Huh. Right. Scully, let's look at the garage. What cars are going to be in there for next week?
So there's a lot of D-Max action, as you would expect, up in Queensland and New South Wales. But we've also got, and a lot of this stuff's under embargo, so it may not go immediately to the site, but the Mercedes-Benz GLA, the new generation one, which is a really big step on from the previous gen car based on what we know so far, and the Toyota Yaris. We now know what it costs. It's going to be interesting to see if it drives well enough to back up that steep price tag. And Audi expert Tony Crawford has been driving the Audi S8 this week. So because of the way COVID's gone, Audi's launched a lot of cars in a very short space of time, and they've done them all in New South Wales, where our only journo is Crawf at the moment. So he's going to be able to give you a rundown from A1 to A8 with RS6 in between by the end of this. But that A8 review will be going live soon as well.
And what else can we see on the site?
So this week coming up, as this podcast goes live, we'll have our Corolla ZR Hybrid review live, which obviously isn't the sexiest car in the world, but is very, very interesting. And, I mean, as we know, Toyota's made huge strides with the Corolla. I really like that, especially the ZR Hybrid. And then next week we've got Kurt's Ford Fiesta ST review going live and our video review of the MG HS we were talking about on the podcast today. The other thing that's live, as people should be listening to this on Monday, hopefully, is a Q&A we did with the Skoda boss in Australia, Michael Irmer. He sat down for an hour with us over Zoom and went through where Skoda's come from, what it's planning to do in the future, and all sorts of other stuff about electric cars and fuel standards in Australia. So if you're the sort of person who likes knowing a little bit more about why a car company is run the way it is, then that's a good one for you to check out.
If you would like to give us any feedback, if you've got anything nice to say, podcast@carexpert.com.au. You can send an email through at any time.
What if I have mean things to say, Mandy?
Mandy. Please do.
If you could just give me an email address, like negativefeedback@carexpert.biz or something, that'd be great. Thanks.
A lot of pent-up rage. This lockdown doing you in.
That's it. I can't take it all out on Will over email.
Scott Colley and Will Stopford, been a pleasure.
It's been a pleasure, but I'd still like that email address, Mandy.
I'll send you nice things, Mandy.
Aw.